The matter of proposed construction of compressor station, may we please have appearances of counsel? Welcome, counsel. Mr. Scott, please go ahead.
If I may, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. If I may, Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine.
Thank you. And may it please the court. This appeal raises a simple but nonetheless significant due process question. That is whether a permittee has the right to intervene in the appeal of its permit. The answer must be yes, because in this case, Tennessee Gas, my client, has a direct, substantial, and protectable interest in its permit that is currently being challenged before the appellate division. And that permitting decision that's under attack by the appellants is a Highlands applicability determination, which is issued by the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. And that was issued to Tennessee in connection with its East 300 upgrade project. And just for some, by way of background, that project is a $246 million expansion to its existing interstate natural gas pipeline system, and includes upgrades to its existing facilities in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and at issue here is the construction of a new electric-driven compressor station in West Milford Township, which is in the Highlands Preservation Area as defined by the Highlands Water Protection and Planning Act. On June 23rd, 2021, the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection, the department, issued the HAD, finding that Tennessee's project qualifies for exemption number 11 for a utility use within the preservation area. And that permit is what's currently being challenged below.
Can you please keep your voice up?
I'm sorry. I apologize. there was no question that the applicability determination is a permitting decision under the Administrative Procedure Act. And there's no dispute that it's a final agency decision appropriately before the appellate division. And while the decision to issue the permit is the department's, the permit itself is Tennessee's and Tennessee's alone. The only objection to Tennessee's intervention below was that the NJDEP adequately represents the Tennessee's interest. However, the agency regulates a permittee, it does not advocate for it. And the department's interest in this case and in the permit is to defend its decision and to administer and enforce the dictates of the Highlands Water Protection and Planning Act and its implementing regulations. Tennessee's interest is in constructing its project and ensuring that it's able to meet its contractual obligations to bring natural gas to its customer in New York. NJDEP does not have an economic interest in the project and will not face financial hardship if the permit is revoked or if Tennessee's project is delayed or put at risk. And nowhere is that clear here than I think in this situation. The NJDEP has had several opportunities to weigh in on this issue and has not taken a position, and in fact has been excused from oral argument here today, claiming that it's neutral in this position. I think it's clear that the department cannot represent Tennessee's interests. If it can't represent it in a threshold issue, whether in determining whether or not Tennessee should even be in the case, then I think it's clear that it cannot represent it on the merits as well. So What is Tennessee asking this court to do? Tennessee is asking this court to determine three things. Ultimately, Tennessee is asking the court to determine that Tennessee may intervene as of right before the appellate division to protect its direct and substantial interest in the permit and to overturn the appellate division's denial of its motions to intervene. However, to get to that point, Tennessee argues or is respectfully requesting that the court determine that the appropriate standard for intervention before the appellate division. There was no dispute below that the parties relied on Rule 4:33. That's obviously a civil trial court rule. It doesn't apply to the appellate division. Typically, that is the rule that is relied upon by you know, appellants or purported interveners in these types of cases. But I think we're asking just for clarification on that point, just to confirm that, you know, we apply the appropriate standard. I don't think there was a question below that that we did. I would also note that the appellate division's decision to deny the motions to intervene is inconsistent with the way the appellate division has previously handled these types of interventions. And we cited to a number of cases in our brief. I'm not going to belabor the point. I will just reference them here. In re petition of South Jersey Gas Company and in re New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection Conditional Highlands applicability determination. And in these cases, parties with a lesser interest in the permit then the permittees were able to intervene, whether on behalf of the environmental groups that were challenging the permit or on behalf of, in the one case, on behalf of the permittee in support of the issuance of the permit. The only difference between, and the latter case that I referenced regarding the Highlands applicability determination, that was in a case that involved Jersey Central Power and Light Company, where it received a Highlands applicability determination from the NJDP for the construction of a substation project, which is similar to Tennessee's project here we're proposing as part of the compressor station project, an electric substation. The only difference procedurally between that case and this was that the that JCP&L, the utility, was named in the notice of appeal. That did not happen here. And we believe that it's necessary for the court to confirm the standard for interventions to, so as to ensure consistency in consideration for motions to intervene and to prevent any you know mischief going forward in terms of parties being omitted. There has to be a way for us to get in the case. Tennessee's ability to protect its interest in its permit cannot depend solely on whether or not it's named in the notice of appeal. I will note, and the court may be aware of this, but the appellants in this case did file, after briefing, the appellant in this case did file an amended notice of appeal naming Tennessee Gas as a respondent. And I'll just note that the appellate division rejected that filing and it basically indicated that it will not, it cannot add Tennessee as a party until this court weighs in and overturns the appellate division's decision. The appellants cannot be the ultimate arbiters of who can or cannot get in the case, and the notice of appeal can't be used as a tool to circumvent the court's order or to try to wrest jurisdiction from this court.
Have you completed your preliminary statement?
I think so. I think I'm out of. I think I've passed the 5 minutes, but I'm.
Okay. You mentioned in your second point that that you operated under 433(1). And that's the way they do this, that the people do this to seeking to intervene on the trial level.
Right.
Generally, when we apply a sort of procedural standard on appeal, there's obviously a standard of review, an appellate review. But, for example, for summary judgment, we look to the summary judgment rule.
Right.
So I thought you were arguing that under 433(1), you had made the showing that needed to be made and you should win under 433. And just from what your second point on your preliminary statement, I'm wondering, are you saying there should be a different rule on appeal?
No, I apologize if there was any confusion. That is exactly what we're saying. We argued below that we met the standard for intervention as of right and that by meeting those factors, we should be in the case. Unlike permissive intervention, 4:33-1, if you meet the factors, you're in the case, right? I mean, that's...
Go ahead.
So you're just looking for clarification that's the appropriate
standard. I just want to confirm it. Yeah,
There was no argument below that this was not the appropriate standard.
Correct. I'm just, I think just as a starting point, want to make, because honestly, I don't know why I'm here. I don't know why the appellate division denied the motion to intervene. There was no statement of reasons. The appellate division wasn't required.
You're absolutely delighted to be here.
I'm stoked. I'm totally stoked to be here. Thank you. Thanks for having me. So to that point, to your point, Your Honor, about meeting the standard, since I don't know why the court denied our motion to intervene, I feel compelled to go through that standard. So under 4:33-1, you know, there's no dispute that Tennessee has a substantial interest in the permit or any interest in the permit. It's their permit. We have an interest in the appeal and the outcome of that appeal. And not only will our interest be impaired at the, that may be impaired at the outcome of that appeal, but if the appellants in the appellate division are successful, that permit could be revoked and it could prevent Tennessee from constructing its project. Not only will its interest be impaired, it would be eviscerated, essentially. And there was no question that we timely intervened. Once we got the notice of appeal, we filed the motion for intervention. I think it was within 2 weeks. Like I said before, the only issue before the that was objected to was whether or not NJDEP adequately represents our interests. And that brings me to the next request for this court, and that is, what is the burden that a party that seeks to intervene needs to meet to show inadequacy of representation?
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, of course.
Because you have a fallback. You have 433-2. And right. It's that last clause, unless the applicant's interest is adequately represented by existing parties. It's that clause that seems to be the subject of a lot of debate.
Yes.
Is it your argument that even if we weren't looking at 433-1, that you should be in this case under 433-2?
Yes, that's correct, Honor. We made both arguments, and we filed initial motion as of right, and then, you know, when that was denied, we sought reconsideration, but also sought as a backup 4:33.
When I'm looking at the two statutes together.
Yes.
I wonder about that last clause, the unless the applicant's interest is adequately represented by existing parties. Because you're saying I have a property interest in this case.
Correct.
That stands to be taken away by this Correct. Particular.
We have a particularized yeah. property interest in the permit. It's our permit. It seems.
And you don't even care whether or not whether DEP seems to represent your interest. You want to protect your own interest.
Correct. Correct. That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. I apologize. And to that point, though, what is the burden that we have to show to prove that our interest is not adequately represented? I don't think we've addressed it, but that was the debate below before the appellate division. The appellants argued, and I thought this was an interesting argument, that the appellate division should follow federal case law. And I thought that was really interesting because it's kind of old hat in the federal courts of appeals as to whether a permittee can intervene in the challenge to its permit. I mean, it's something that I've done before on behalf of another pipeline client in the Third Circuit. I know this is anecdotal. Tennessee has done it previously regularly before the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, the First Circuit, the Third Circuit. You know, anytime these permits are issued, and now it's a little different. The federal court rule 15 specifically says, you know, the agency is the respondent. Everyone else has to file a motion to intervene. So it's a little different from a rule
is,
here.
Is it your position as simple as this? We have an economic interest. They have an environmental interest. And that's good enough to make this point.
Yes, I think so. I think the burden is a minimal one. We have an economic interest. The department can't represent our interests. The department has an obligation to uphold, you know, to protect the environment, to you know, administer, you know, the Highlands Water Protection Planning Act and its implementing rules. It has an enforcement role as well under the act and the regulations. It issues the permit, but it doesn't act. It regulates. And I'm quoting this from the Seventh Circuit decision. I know we quoted to it a lot in our briefs below, but I think that court really analyzed this issue as to adequacy of a representation and how it applies in this context where you have a permit and permit.
Bearing in mind that whatever rule this court adopts in this case could affect cases outside of the environmental area.
Absolutely.
What is your principled statement of what the burden should be that would not lower the bar so much that anyone who can say my interest is not quite as aligned with these other people who are perhaps, you know, I'm a nonprofit, they have a slightly different take on it, and the ones that are parties are in there, and therefore I should have a right to intervene. Obviously, the specter of 100 parties in a controversial issue of some kind,
right?
could overwhelm judicial resources. So what's the test, what's the standard that you would have us apply that could apply beyond environmental permitting that you think is the fair one?
I would direct the court to, you know, the way the federal courts have interpreted this rule. Obviously, the way the federal courts have interpreted the rule is not binding on this court, but I think it is highly persuasive, since, you know, our rule is substantially verbatim, you know, the federal court rule 24.
And so what is the burden that federal courts generally impose in these situations?
The burden, as expressed by the U.S. Supreme Court and as has pretty much been taken and run with the lower courts, is that the burden is a minimal one, that the party seeking to intervene must only show that its interest may not be adequately represented by the existing party, and the burden of establishing that is a minimal one.
But that's not consistently true throughout the circuits, is it?
No, it's not. It's not consistent. I mean, there are certain, I'll say, ratcheting standards based on.
For example, the First Circuit adopted a standard that said to overcome this presumption, it provides that person seeking to intervene seeks to appear alongside a governmental agency in defense of validity of some official action, there's a rebuttable presumption arises that the government adequately represents the interests of the would-be intervener. And to overcome the presumption, the putative intervener would have to have put forward a strong affirmative showing that the public agency does not adequately represent their interests. That's the standard in the First Circuit. And a similar one to an appellate division in this court, in this jurisdiction. The appellate division adopted one when addressing an issue of an appeal from a zoning board in action in lieu of prerogative writs. What would be, in your opinion, problematic with this standard?
I think the standard is too, in that case, would be too strict of a standard. It would keep out, I think, too many interested parties. I mean, in this case, I'll put it this way: permittees in this state are typically involved in the defense of their permits. They're just typically named at the outset. But so, the government in this instance, and I don't know which, if I may, Your Honor, the first.
Give you the name of the case. It's T-Mobile versus the Township of Burnsdale, and it's at 136 F3rd 197.
Okay, I apologize. I'm not familiar with the case, but in any event, I think I agree that it depends. I think what the court, in order to determine the standard or the burden, the court has to make a discerning analysis as to what the interests are, because it's not, I think, if I understand correctly, and this is the way this, I'll go with the Seventh Circuit, the way they framed it, is that it requires a discerning analysis of what the interests of the parties are. It's not just whether you're intervening on the same side of the V. It's not enough that, so in this case, the appellants were arguing that because the because Tennessee and NJDEP both want to uphold the permit, that it triggers that rebuttal presumption, the ultimate goal test. And I don't know if that's what the where the First Circuit was going with that, because I know that a number of the courts and the appellants referenced this below. A number of the courts do employ the ultimate goal test, but the ultimate goal test, which is like I said, it requires a more discerning analysis of the interests of the parties. It can't just be because we're intervening on the side of the government. I'm not familiar with the First Circuit decision, but I do know that it requires a more discerning analysis than just whether or not we're on the same side.
Hard to imagine a entity with a more substantial interest than the one that you present. You have a permit that has been conferred on you by the DEP, and you're dependent upon that in order to do business, in order to continue with this particular project. So when you're talking about weighing interest, in the T-Mobile case, you're dealing with a township that has issued a permit, and the interveners are citizens who want to have their interests. And then the argument is that the township is going to protect their interests. That's different from this particular case. You have a property interest that I can't imagine can be more significant and which is at stake in this case.
I agree, Your Honor, because what the appellate division is asking us to do is, by denying the motion to intervene, we are sitting on the sidelines while two parties that really don't have that particularized property interest in the permit are arguing over whether or not that decision and ultimately that permit should go away. And that seems patently unfair.
One of the things that the First Circuit talked about in the Barnstable case was whether the court observed that the proposed interveners had not identified any argument that the town was unlikely to make, and that was all part of that inquiry. What arguments do you proffer here that the DEP is unlikely to make? You've already told us the DEP is not intervening here, not making any arguments, but just in the entire substantive appeal.
I think potentially, Your Honor, at this point, there may be a point in time where we want to make a mootness argument. I mean, there's going to come a point in time when my client is going to receive its ultimate approval from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and it's a notice to proceed, and it's going to seek to begin construction on its project. I don't know where the appeal is going to be in that point. I don't know if mootness is even going to be successful, but that may be one type of argument that we may want to raise. I mean,
So Rule 433-3, designed for the trial court, says submit a pleading that sets forth claims or defenses.
Correct.
You've submitted a certification, but it's largely a fact-laden certification that doesn't identify legal theories or claims that Justice Patterson was just asking you for. Why hasn't that already been presented?
Admittedly, Your Honor, and this is on me as the attorney, but I think when we spoke with the appellate division to confirm what we needed to file to get in the case, we were told that once the motion to intervene was approved, that we can then file the CIS and set forth what information is required by the rule. But typically, in the appellate division, I don't think we're necessarily. My understanding is we're not filing our briefs at the outset. It would just be a CIS, which is what the appellants argued. They basically said we didn't file the CIS. But the CIS is only going to include information about who my client is, Tennessee Gas Pipeline Company, who their attorney is, me, and the statement of the procedure with the factual background. It doesn't require.
So I'm looking at the rule.
Yes.
Which is keyed toward having the party come forward with some statement of its claims or defenses, not necessarily looking at the CIS.
What,
as we give guidance in this opinion going forward, what should be required? And then secondarily, I'd like you to finish your answer to Justice Patterson's question and tell us what claims and theories you will be presenting. There's been a fair amount of time since the August 2021 certification. You should be able to tell us that. So what should be required, and what would you bring to the case?
So in terms of what should be required, I suppose potentially a, you know, I suppose we could provide some sort of just a statement of how we would, either support the DEP's decision, whether that's to support its argument that its decision to the issue the permit was not arbitrary and capricious, but I think what's difficult is I don't know. There's no statement of issues. Nothing's been done at the appellate division.
May I follow up, please? When you're seeking to amend a complaint, you submit with your motion your proposed amended complaint. Would it make sense for someone in your situation to submit a complaint as an intervener, a proposed complaint?
I don't know if that would make sense in this case, Your Honor, only because we're intervening on behalf of the as a respondent.
As a respondent, whatever the pleading would be that ultimately, if you were allowed to intervene, you would have as your initial pleading, no matter what side you're on.
Right, and I don't know that there is one in this case. I'm not sure what we would be filing as a pleading. That's what, that's...
Because you're going in on appeal.
Right, exactly.
So what about a merits-based document of sorts, whether it's akin to a merits brief or an outline of the argument, rather than simply a statement of facts, because that seems to be what the rule was getting at.
Right. Unfortunately, Your Honor, I don't know what... I have an idea of what the arguments are going to be. I mean, the appellants set forth their potential arguments in their CIS, but that's all I have to go off of. I don't know. I don't have any rationale to respond to. There's nothing that... there's no legal concepts that I can really... I'm not sure how else to respond to just a state, you know, an itemized list of the issues that they're planning on raising. I mean, I will say in their CIS, they do raise a number of issues about, you know, whether a fossil fuel project is consistent with, you know, the goals and objectives of the Highlands Water Protection and Planning Act, you know, just generally arguing that Tennessee's project is not a routine upgrade and therefore does not qualify for you know, the exemption. I guess I have something to go off of, I suppose.
This is an unusual case.
It's so unusual.
It's an administrative appeal. This isn't like as though a complaint has been filed, and you would be filing as a pleading an answer in response to the complaint. So this is a different creature.
Right. That's correct. I'm struggling here because there's not much for me to go off. I just have an itemized list of the arguments, the potential points that...
Presumably, the bases for the DEP's decision,
we're going to support that decision. I mean, the exemption applies to utility uses, you know, upgrades to utility facilities within the Highlands Preservation Area. So we can, you know, Tennessee is the one that's building the project. We submitted the application. Nobody knows our project better than Tennessee. And the department obviously reviewed our application and has that information available to us.
So you're basically on parallel track with the DEP in that regard. Is there another argument, following up on the chief's second question, is there another argument that you would raise that DEP might not raise on appeal?
Obviously my client is a federally regulated interstate natural gas pipeline company. It's regulated by the FERC. That comes with it certain rights, I'll say, but, you know, there is an argument to be made that the Highlands Water Protection Planning Act is a state law, and to the extent it could be used to prohibit or interfere with my client's project, that it is preempted by federal law. I mean,
that's where I thought you might be going.
Yes.
And begs the question, is a certification that just sets forth some basic facts without a rough outline of the legal claims that you might be bringing to the case adequate? What's the best way for the court to proceed if it needed to revise the rule in this regard? It would seem to me that some form of statement outlining the legal theories that you intend to bring into the case would certainly be helpful and could bear on the adequacy of representation from those in the case already. Not necessarily a 50-page brief, but some form of document outlining your legal theories.
I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. I think it's still difficult for me to conceive in a situation like this, because there are instances where I apologize. I'm trying to think through your question because it's a. I'm struggling with this one because I only have a limited amount of information. I don't know. There may be, you know, like I said.
How about a proposed CIS?
Yeah, I mean that would be
attachments for legal arguments.
That would work as well. But again, it's hard for me to make some of these legal arguments. I like the preemption ones, but not every. Here's the thing, not every...
You mentioned preemption, so let's have a simple question. Can you raise that preemption argument for the first time on appeal without exhausting your administrative remedies? Did you raise that before the DEP?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, I think it's been through our filing. I mean, FERC requires us, or I shouldn't say requires, encourages interstate natural gas pipeline companies to apply for and work with state and local agencies. But to the extent that state laws could prohibit or somehow interfere with those projects, you know, they are considered preempted by federal law. So we make clear in our application and certain filings with the department that, you know, we're doing this, we're cooperating with the agency because we want to work with the agency, we're respecting its rules and regulations, but to the extent that this could be used to, you know, prevent the project, you know, it's preempted.
Did the commissioner pass on that issue?
Did the commission pass on?
The commissioner of the DEP. On your preemption argument.
No, they did not. All we have is the exemption. They granted the right. Exemption.
So you would be making an argument as an intervener attacking the right of the DEP to interfere with your project based on federal preemption?
Yes.
So instead of defending the DEP, well, it would be there as another rival to the DEP.
I think our main goal is to defend the permit, obviously. We want to support the department, but we have our own perspective, our own interest in this case. That's not the first argument that I want to make, is that I don't want to burn the whole thing to the ground and say it's preempted. That's not...
If you had no preemption argument, you'd be here and saying, my interest is at the center of this entire controversy over
right.
here, and we have a right to be here.
Correct. We have a substantial, a direct, and protectable interest that we need to have a say. I think we need to have a seat at the table.
Is it your argument that your due process rights would be violated if you are not permitted to be at the table here?
Yes, that is the argument that we made. Due process requires notice and the opportunity to be heard, and the process that you know, the way that this court has framed it in the past, you know, whether it's the particularized property interest or, you know, we talk about Matthews. I know Matthews is typically used in the context of, you know, adjudicatory hearing requests and evidentiary hearings, but this court has looked at, you know, the nature of the property interest and the extent of the
deprivation. But you want us to engage in constitutional avoidance to read the rules so that we don't have a potential constitutional conflict.
Correct. That's
right.
Correct.
I take it from the very beginning, your contention's been that the exemption number 11 was correctly granted by the DEP because you fit within those parameters.
Correct.
Isn't that your legal argument?
Yes.
And is that contained anywhere in anything that you have filed with the court to date?
Is
that simple statement?
No, I don't believe. I don't.
So in coming back to what the Chief said, wouldn't it be appropriate simply to attach to the motion that the reason that we have a right to be here and what we intend to argue is that, first of all, we have a right to be here because we have an interest, a property interest separate part of the DEP, and the DEP was correct in granting exemption number 11 because we are maintenance, up whatever. How difficult would that be?
I don't think it's difficult at all.
So if the outcome is that that's what should be provided, it wouldn't be a problem for an intervener such as yourself to provide that at the time of filing.
Right. That would not be an issue.
Just making sure.
Anything else you'd like to add at this time?
I would just add that, you know, as we mentioned in our brief, and I think it was alluded to here, this is not. It's not just about one permit, one permittee, or one state agency. This case has implications for other agencies, the other state agencies that issue permits or approvals, the BPU, Department of Community Affairs, the NJDEP. I think it's imperative that interveners understand, you know, the standard that applies, and they're you know, be able to show that, you know, their interests are not adequately represented, and to be able to protect their substantial interest in their permits.
One last question, if I may, Chief. You just referenced other agencies, agency appeals to the appellate division. doesn't your argument potentially apply outside of administrative appeals?
Yes.
To court proceedings in which someone seeks to intervene? I mean, it really isn't just an issue of agency. So, if that's so, what do we need to keep in mind about the distinction between an administrative appeal to the appellate division after an agency final determination and a court proceeding in which the trial court handles the matter as the court of initial jurisdiction?
I apologize for the delay, Your Honor. I'm thinking through that one. I think maybe to your initial point, which was, you know, how do we, you know, framing in a way that doesn't, you know, what's the line for, you know, allowing in interveners and ensuring that, you know, it doesn't, you know, that interested parties are able to intervene and represent their interests, but that, you know, it's not unwieldy. And in the agency context, you usually have a set number of parties that are parties to that administrative hearing. I'm probably overgeneralizing this too much, but I'm just thinking, you know, like a BPU proceeding where you have, you know, a number of parties, you know, the utility, the Division of Rate Council, you have maybe a few interveners in that case.
You're suggesting a rule that only applies to agency appeals and leave other situations to a different case?
It's hard for me to, I mean, intervention, the 4:3, we're only, this case is, I think this does have other implications for this case is analyzing, you know, the standard for intervention. I think it would have a broader reach than just the administrative appeal process.
Can I ask one more, Chief?
I'm sorry.
You have three environmental groups here.
Yes.
You're asking for a minimal standard. It gets to appeal. Your adversary's colleagues in the environmental group world come forward, a dozen of them, all saying, we're interested in a particular part of the Highlands. We have water as our focus. We're concerned about forestry, all the different interests. Do they all come in as interveners?
I think the court has to look at and have a discerning analysis as to what those interests are. Maybe there's a historic preservation group, or maybe there's a group that focuses on, you know, wetlands issues. I think there has to be analysis of what those issues are.
If an individual group can say, well, the Sierra Club is focused on X, but I go a little bit X and Y and Z, right, in my interest, a little bit broader, are they in as interveners? Because what the standard you articulated,
right,
is a low bar.
It, yes.
It's just a different interest, a slightly different interest.
Yes. I mean, I think, if you're saying the Sierra Club is already in the case, and if there was another,
yeah, Sierra Club's in the case.
I mean, it is a low bar, but
I said historic preservation.
Yeah,
we're interested in the buildings,
right?
You know, the historic buildings in the Highlands. We're not as interested as the Sierra, in the natural resources as the Sierra Club. So we're in too.
Right. I think in those instances, I think they would be able to, they should be able to intervene. And in fact, in the one case that we cited to the new, you know, the JCP&L case, I think that there was a, I think it was a historic preservation group, and then there's another intervener for the another environmental group intervened to challenge the permit. So that was permitted. I don't see necessarily an issue with that. It can't be just because we're on the same side of the V. Like, that's, you know, just it can't be that. That's too high of a burden. It has to be something less than that. I think that's what we're arguing. It should be a minimal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Scott.
Thank you.
Gross.
May it please the court. So we represent slightly different interests. We represent a number of business groups who obtain approvals administratively. And I think the court is grappling with the standard in terms of intervention. We don't think the court has to get there. this appeal should have named the permittee as a party under Rule 251. It's clear that in the, either the trial court perspective or the administrative perspective, Rule 251 requires an appellant to name the party below, all the parties below.
Which is the last question I was going to ask the appellant here, so I'm going to ask you, and you're right on it. Should every permittee automatically have a right to intervene?
Yes. Okay. But I don't think you I think there's no reason to burden the appellate division with motions that are unnecessary, because under Rule 251, that party, that permittee, must be named in the appeal. And if you look at the appellate division CIS, the case information statement that Justice Patterson alluded to, that requires in item four and the instructions for item four for all parties below to be named as parties in the appeal. So why burden the appellate division with the motions to intervene by a party below when under Rule 251, it's a violation of the rule not to name them as a party? And as amicus, that's what, normally we know that the court likes to be constrained and narrow its decisions, but in this case—
In your experience, is that routinely done?
Absolutely. Our firm represents developers primarily, but I have never been confronted with an instance where there's been an appeal by an environmental group or another other interested party that did not name us as a party. I've never had to move to intervene or move to be a part of the case pursuant to Rule 251. Never in my practice.
Your suggestion is simply forgetting the intervention issue under 251 as the permittee. They were required to be named as a party in the notice of appeal and should not have had to intervene.
Absolutely.
The failure to name them was a failure on the part of the appellants.
Correct. That's where, from our perspective—
We don't ever get to 433-1.
I'm sorry.
So we don't ever get to 433-1.
Correct. That's our point. And if you get to 433, it seems to me, if you want to opine as to 433, a party below, be it in the trial court or in the appellate practice, should be automatically be allowed to intervene. But I don't think you have to get there. I don't think, why burden the appellate court with motions to intervene when originally the notice of appeal should have included the permittee? The appellate court, I'm sure you've heard from appellate division judges, they have a lot of work. Why add to their workload?
That's what I heard.
by motions that should not have to be made, because those permittees under Rule 251 should be named in the notice of appeal and the CIS. It was a violation of the rules of the CIS not to name Tennessee in this matter.
But isn't an appellant a party in the original forum where the appeal is taken from? I mean, public entity, the groups that are now seeking to challenge the decision of the DEP, were they part of the process when the applicant was making its request for an...
Frankly, I don't know, Your Honor.
I mean, that's usually what happens is, and if someone appeals something because they were a party in the original forum.
So they may have submitted comments, but they weren't. I mean, there could be hundreds of comments submitted. They may have submitted one of the comments. I don't think that makes them a party below just because
right.
they submitted comments.
And that Judge Fuentes' question raises that as well for me in terms of administrative appeals are different from court proceedings insofar
yeah.
as court proceedings have a set number of parties that are defined. Sometimes they. They're gone by the time there's an appeal, or they're not involved with the appeal, but you have a finite group of people. You have a situation like this, you could have many people going to the agency and saying, don't allow this or do allow it. What defines a party in an administrative proceeding like this?
Well, below, the only parties are the applicant and the agency. Now, there are some agencies where, for instance, at the BPU, the rate council is a party to those rate proceedings. And by the way, can you imagine a BPU rate case where the BPU grants the utility the rate increase, there's an appeal, and that utility isn't named as a party in the appeal, and so that case goes to the appellate division without the utility. It's analogous to this situation where you have the permittee, which I agree with Justice Albin, has a property right here. So if you don't accept our argument that under 251, the permittee has to be named in the appeal, at least in terms of 433, you should indicate that the permittee below automatically has the right to intervene. But again,
what you're saying here is that Tennessee didn't have the opportunity to make that argument below because the issue only arose when the appellants filed the appeal and didn't name them as a party.
Correct. But I think the correct motion should have been to the appellate division to require the civil information statement to be amended to name Tennessee in the appeal. That's how I would have handled it below. I would have probably not have moved to intervene. I would have indicated that as of right under 251, Tennessee should have been a party.
Tell us generally from your experience in the construction area, who's at the table at the trial court and at the appellate division?
Well, there are very few trial court cases. It's mostly administrative. At the table are generally the applicant and DEP. I have been involved in some rare cases where there's an environmental group and DEP will meet with them separately. And of course, they're entitled to file comments on the application. There is a vigorous public comment process at the administrative agencies. But generally, it's just the applicant and DEP. As a matter of fact, if the applicant requests a meeting with DEP and another group wants to attend, DEP generally does not allow them to attend that meeting.
Anything else you'd like to present?
Well, let me just posit a hypothetical here that if the appellate division's determination not to allow intervention were upheld, under the civil settlement process in the appellate division, there could be a settlement conference between these environmental groups and DEP. The case could be settled without Tennessee's involvement. Tennessee could appeal from that settlement, not name the environmental groups as a party, go through the settlement process, settle its differences with DEP, and then the environmental groups would have a right to appeal. So you'd have this continual appeal process, and there's no reason for it. There's not even a reason for a motion to intervene in this case. There may be certainly in other cases where there's not a party below that is involved who wants to intervene. But here, where the party, the applicant is below, and in trial court, where one of the litigants is a party, under Rule 251, I believe that there's an absolute requirement to name those parties in the notice of appeal.
You've been at this a while.
A while. I have a lot of gray hair.
Are you aware of a case where the permittee has not been a party to an action of this type?
No, that's what the Chief Justice asked me. No, this is the first time I've ever seen a case where the permittee was not named as a party in an appellate proceeding.
In those cases where the permittee has been a party to the proceedings, were the groups like the group that we have here involved at the administrative level in any way, even if it was not completely involved, but their presence was known, their position was known?
Yes. Yes.
Mostly in commenting.
Almost exclusively in commenting.
With the analogy of a zoning board where the there may be people objecting to the applicant's zoning changes or the right to construct a building in a particular zone. Would that be a fair is that analogous to what we have here, or is that not really applicable?
It's somewhat analogous, but in that situation, sometimes those objectors are represented by counsel.
That's right.
Sometimes there's a group, that's an organized group, and you know, typically they might appeal.
They're part of the record that's developed before the zoning.
They're part of the record. They can cross-examine witnesses. In the administrative context, it's a little bit different. They can just comment. That's really all they can do. Once in a while, as I indicated, they will request a meeting with DEP. Sometimes that's granted, sometimes it's not. But generally, they're just commenters.
In action in lieu of prerogative writs. So you're at the zoning board,
right?
And a permit is granted, and then some citizen files an action in lieu of prerogative writ against the planning board. Is the permittee, the person who got the permit, involved in that action?
Again, I've never seen a case, and we're involved in those kinds of land use approvals also. I've never seen a case where the permittee was not mentioned in the case information statement, in the CIS.
As a party?
As a party. Definitely.
So they're getting notice as a party?
Correct. It's just standard procedure. You always reference the applicant. It's really the applicant as a party.
Thank you, Mr. Gross.
Thank you.
Mr. Greenhouse.
Thank you. May it please the court. Your Honors, I'd like to start with the fact that this court's March 15th order of this year limited Amici, the builder's participation to this matter as filing a brief. So it comes as a surprise to me, and I would also add a prejudice to my clients that the builders have participated at oral argument today. The arguments that the builders raised regarding the adequacy of the notice of appeal and the CIS was not raised by the Tennessee Gas Pipeline Company in the motions to intervene or in the papers to this court. And so I'll do my best to rebut those arguments here, but I'm going on the assumption that the court has issued a decision in the interim since its March 15th order. I think to be verbally and legally accurate, we cannot call Tennessee Gas Pipeline a permittee in this case. The Department of Environmental Protection issued a Highlands applicability determination, which is not a permit. It exempts Tennessee Gas Pipeline Company from going through the permitting process. So it was not a permit review that resulted in the HAD. It was not a permit application which resulted in the administrative decision which is at issue.
Give it a name.
It's a Highlands applicability determination. We call it colloquially HAD number 11 because there are 17 exemptions.
So they ruled in their favor and they gave them a right to do this construction, which, right?
The department decided, using its authority granted to it by the Highlands Act, decided that the proposal fit within one of the exemptions under the statute.
They gave them permission to go forward, whatever name you call it. They gave them permission. They granted them something.
Your Honor, I appreciate that there are similarities, but I also think there are differences.
Okay, tell us what they are.
An exemption is the lack of a permitting review. So under the
Highlands Act. Is there such a word as exemptee? Is that what they are?
Trying to invent such a word
if it doesn't exist?
Your Honor, I don't think that there is a case which in New Jersey or that I'm aware of which defines exactly what an exemption would be called.
But if you win, in the end, they can't go forward.
No, Your Honor, if the Highlands applicability determination at issue is overturned, then they would have to go through the permitting process and receive and apply for and receive a Highlands Preservation Area approval, an HPAA.
So that matters a great deal to them. Why shouldn't they be at the table for the appeal?
Your Honor, the reason, I think that the discussion we just heard was culminated really at the point of the Justice's remark regarding, how can you argue that preemption, how can you raise a federal preemption argument as an intervener to support the DEP's issuance of this exemption? That's what we were faced with in the motions to intervene. So we didn't challenge the interest, although it's an exemption versus a permit. These might be consequential, or the distinction might be of little consequence. I think it's of more consequence the builder's arguments.
Could you keep your voice up, please?
Yes.
Trailing off.
Yes. Thank you. So we didn't argue about their interests. We argued that, as of right, the department could be presumed to adequately defend the administrative decision at issue.
Can I ask you a very pragmatic question?
Yes.
Why do you care? Tennessee got a favorable ruling. They want to protect their favorable ruling. Your argument is either persuasive and will win the day, or it won't. Why are you afraid that Tennessee is going to make an argument?
Thank you for asking me that, Your Honor. The reason we are objecting is because the Tennessee Gas Pipeline threatened to bring this federal preemption argument to the case, to our appeal of the department's decision. So we challenged the department's decision, and you can look at our CIS. We list out with specificity the legal issues that we raised.
So you didn't name them as a party in order to keep them from making that preemption argument?
No, Your Honor. I think that there are two directions you can look at this from. I think you recognize, based upon the discussion that we already had this morning, that the universe of potential parties to this matter might be large. There might be further parties out there.
But Tennessee is a clear potential party, correct? And counsel for Tennessee Gas indicated that you have filed an amended notice of appeal adding them as a party at this point.
That was rejected, Your Honor.
Right, but you filed it.
Yes.
Why?
To resolve the matter.
To resolve this matter.
To avoid coming here.
I think everyone wants to avoid coming here.
Apparently.
I don't blame
you. I'm happy to be here.
You agree, though, therefore, in response to what Justice Albin said, Tennessee clearly has an interest. They were involved in the initial DEP proceeding, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And they clearly have an interest.
Yes, Your Honor.
And they could have easily, since they have an interest and they were involved in the original proceeding, could have been named in the notice of appeal.
They could have been, but again, we don't know the whole universe.
I understand. We're not worried about anybody else. We only know about you two parties. That's it. So there may be millions, but we have you before us. So, and you knew they were here. You know who the others are, but you knew they were here. You knew they were involved. You could have named them in the notice of appeal. You did not because of the preemption issue. So that, put preemption aside. Based on their argument today, and I think counsel was really struggling with the preemption question, is that something they should be raising in this context? But with respect to the argument that they have an interest, separate apart from DEP's interest, certainly adverse to your interest, they should be a party. You agree with that? Put preemption aside.
Separate and apart?
Separate and apart. Not included. Excluded.
But maybe not different.
Preemption.
Because the record is closed. It's an administrative decision. The record is closed. There could be motions to supplement or open the record, but as of now, the administrative record has been set, and there is only, you know, legal arguments to make, and the Department of Environmental Protection is represented by the Division of Law in the Attorney General's office.
And you're saying that only argument in the record below is preemption?
No, Your Honor. In fact, we haven't seen the record yet. So I'm not aware of
Let me go back to my question. You're sitting here agreeing they have an interest.
Yes.
Tennessee is here because they have an interest. Your concern is you don't want to concede or in any way further the preemption argument, because then there's a problem going forward with all the applications for permits. What did you call it? HAD 11 exemptions? They'd all be exempt, I guess. Well, whatever. Your argument is you're trying to stop this preemption argument. Okay, we're here today. They're saying to us, we have an interest. It's a financial property interest. We were a party below. We should have been named in the notice of appeal for that reason. Limited solely to that issue. Do you have any dispute?
No, Your Honor.
In the other lawsuits that your groups bring, do they name the permittee or in a case where there's an exemption from going through the permit process, the person who or entity that has the exemption?
I think so, Your Honor.
So your clients are taking a special position here based on a concern, and I understand the strategic concern, but based on saying we're not going to name them as a party because the scary argument out there is preemption, and we don't want anybody in the case making that argument. Is that what we're dealing with here?
Your Honor, I don't think that question can really be answered without going back in time. I don't remember exactly,
okay,
you know, what transpired. I think what's relevant to the court.
I'm not asking you to in any way testify. That's not what we're here for. But it is of interest that other groups whom you ably represent routinely would put someone in Tennessee's position on the CIS as a party, and here we have a case being handled differently.
I understand your concern. I understand the court's concern in that regard, and I think that there is not a requirement in the rule that requires a searching in an administrative proceeding like this, where there may be parties with equal property interests at stake. There might be somebody who lives next door.
But obviously there's notification rules on how close someone might live. But do you dispute that a party who either did or did not, in this case did, get an exemption from going through the permitting process should be a party when that is challenged on appeal?
Your Honor, I think the motion to intervene was appropriate. I think that we opposed it in a non-frivolous way, and that the court, the appellate division, decided correctly without abusing its discretion to deny both motions to intervene.
The 251D, you heard that?
Yes.
You concede that Tennessee is an interested party. We don't have to talk about amorphous other organizations or people who could be an interested party. They're an interested party. You concede that, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
You concede under 251D that they should have been noticed, and you actually filed an amended notice with them as an interested party, correct?
Your Honor, I don't concede that there were any errors at the outset. I think the appellate division...
You filed an amended notice. That was non-frivolous.
Yes.
Okay? You did it for a reason.
Yes, sir.
You did it because you thought they were an interested party, correct?
Yes, sir.
You thought, and I'm assuming you filed that notice because you thought they should be, and we've been using this term, at the table, a party to the appeal, correct?
Yes, sir.
So if that's the case, we don't even have to get to those other rules, do we?
I thought that would have resolved this issue. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so we don't have to go any further than 251D to resolve this case.
Your Honor, I would note that with regard to the court's concerns about setting a precedent and requiring a pleading, there was, I do believe, a procedural defect in the motions to intervene. And I think that the court, the appellate division, was properly concerned with the scope of the appeal and it potentially becoming unduly complicated by a preemption argument.
That's not quite what we're talking about here. We're talking about whether they should have been named as a party in your CIS. Right? And by submitting another one, albeit it was rejected, but by submitting a CIS with them on it, presumably, you're saying they're a party. It's kind of a simple yes or no question. They are a party to this appeal. So I think we may have agreement in this courtroom among counsel that they are a party to the appeal. Correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you've put in your briefs that they would be able to seek review of an appellate ruling, even if they were out of the case, that they could seek relief from this court, which suggests they should have that same right in front of the appellate division. No? Isn't there a tension between the arguments?
I agree that the procedural posture is a bit confusing. Yes, Your Honor.
So what should we do at this point?
Your Honor, I don't think that there is really anything that needs to be fixed in the process. I don't believe that the appellate division abused its discretion to deny the motion to intervene. I believe
Why was your amended notice rejected? Who rejected that?
I received a communication from the case manager in the appellate division that the court's orders on the motions to intervene were within this court's jurisdiction now and that they could not be changed.
So this was after this court
accepted.
Yeah, but you're basically, tell me if I'm mistaken, admitting that the original notice should have had Tennessee on it.
Not exactly, no. It could have, but again, without benefit of seeing the record before the agency and knowing all of the parties that participated below.
All of the parties. I mean, tennis, what were you intervening? Like, why would you be appealing a decision of the DEP if it weren't for the fact that Tennessee was given the exemption to go forward with this project? Forget about anyone else. Tennessee.
Well, you
didn't know Tennessee got the project?
Your Honor, again, I think you could go in both directions. You could go in the direction of looking at parties besides Tennessee, or you could go in the direction of, oh, well, maybe I should have named Kinder Morgan because they own Tennessee Gas Pipeline. Well, I don't think that's on the plate when you file a notice of appeal. They were noticed of our notice of appeal relatively quickly. You might notice that they filed the motion to intervene about 2 weeks later. And so it really isn't a question of whether they had been provided with notice, which is really the underlying question regarding all of these due process concerns. They were on notice. They knew. They filed a motion to intervene.
I don't know what that means. Because forgive me for harping on 251D. It's a rule. And it's a rule that requires that a notice of appeal be given to an interested party, correct?
I don't have the rule open in front of me, Your Honor, but
Serving copies of the notice of appeal on the agency or officer, the attorney general, and all other interested parties. Take it from me. That's the rule.
Yes.
You concede that Tennessee was an interested party, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So, therefore, they should have been noticed.
They were noticed, Your Honor.
Okay.
Should have been named.
Named.
Okay. And that would have given them a right to participate in the appeal, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And therefore, there's no need to look to the intervention rule. Because if you're named as a party and you're in the appeal, you don't have to intervene, correct?
That line of reasoning was exactly what I was thinking when I filed the amended notice of appeal.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Mr. Scott, any rebuttal?
Very briefly.
I just want to address the point, really two points. and we kind of talked about this in my first go around. There's no dispute that the HAD is a permitting decision as that term is defined under the Administrative Procedure Act.
I'm sorry, that what is a permanent decision?
The Highlands Applicability Determination. Okay. Granting the exemption is a permitting decision under the Administrative Procedures Act. It's an approval. It, as Justice Albin noted, it allows us to go forward and to. So let me put it this way: there are two routes that a developer can go. Either apply for a Highlands Applicability Determination seeking exemption from the Act and the implementing regulations, or it can submit to jurisdiction and basically apply for a Highlands Preservation Area approval and be subject to, you know, all the substantive standards. In this instance, as Tennessee has done on its past two projects in the Highlands Preservation Area, it sought the exemption and received it. That allows, by having that exemption in hand, that allows under DEP's regulations for the developer to essentially apply for other permits and go forward with other permitting needs. I don't think there's any dispute. It's a permit. It allows us to. It's a right that we have to go forward and to apply for other permits to construct our facilities, subject to obtaining all other necessary federal, state, local approvals, et cetera.
So you're saying your client should be considered a permittee?
Correct. And I just want to talk about notice, because the only reason we received notice of this appeal was because my office was stalking the appellate division's docket and saw that something was filed. We calendared it, we knew what the 45 days was, and we just routinely checked it. And we eventually saw that there was this appeal. We, you know, spoke to the clerk, we found out who the attorneys were, we reached out to the attorneys. I requested a copy from Mr. Greenhouse. I requested the information from the DAG's office and from the DEP itself. And eventually I did get it from, I got it from the parties. But I shouldn't have to go around begging for it.
The appellants did not provide you with notice?
No, only when I asked for it, and several days after that. It took them a few days to get it to me, but they got it to me eventually. So, and we were able to intervene. And I will note, as to the Rule 251 discussion, if that is the way that I don't know that I would have done it any differently. I think we would have still had to file either whether it's a motion to intervene based on the rule. I'm not exactly sure procedurally what it is, but I agree that it wouldn't obviate the need. We'd have to file some sort of motion, I think, before the appellate division to argue that we should have.
When you're not named as a party, you can't demand to be named as a party.
Right. I feel like
I really want to be in this litigation. You can't say that.
Right.
You if that's up to the person filing the appeal.
Right. That's
so. Intervention was the option that you had.
I think that's right. It doesn't obviate the need to seek intervention. That is all I have. I appreciate the court's the opportunity to argue this important case. Thank you so much.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.